This interview with Mark DeMines was recorded on November 9th, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
Definitely, I'm from Baltimore, born in Baltimore City. I can't say I was raised in Baltimore City because 32 years and some odd change in my life was spent in prison. But yes, I'm from Baltimore City.
Describe growing up for us briefly. Was it was it hard, easy, or in between?
I want to say at times it was more harder than easy. Never easy. Never easy. Always hard or in between. More hard tonight, than in between.
Tonight we're going to talk about three basic issues. What it was like before you went in, while you were in, and once you came out. So, you know, we're in a learning environment. You know, I have like about, 16 fellows. We call our students fellows because we look up to them like that. They're just prestigious like that, you know? They go beyond fellows because they're sharp, man. They're smart. And they're going to be asking you some good questions tonight. And we really appreciate you being with us. So, again, we're going to talk about before, during, and after. So, let me start off, and then after a while, our fellows are going to throw questions at you. So is that all right with you?
Of course.
What led to you getting sentenced and being convicted?
What led to me being sentenced and convicted was I had I was locked up. I was arrested for a murder charge. And I was 16 at the time, and it was drug related. And but the twist was the guy that was killed was what we called in Baltimore City at the time is a stick up guy, a guy that robbed drug dealers. So that's what he did. He was robbing drug dealers, and a fight broke out, and ultimately the guy was shot and killed. What led to me getting life though? Because I told this story to the police from day one, but what led to me getting life though was the fact that I had a ballistic expert named Joseph Caparo. And later on down the line, it was found out that he was corrupt, he was crooked, and he committed suicide in 2007, I believe. But nevertheless, he lied. He flat out lied in my case and forged some evidence and told the people that the story that I gave couldn't have happened that way. In spite of the evidence, the physical evidence showing that what I said happened is what happened. Because the evidence showed that we was at close range. The evidence showed we was at such a close range that when the shot was fired, it caused singeing and burning of the individual's skin. And his clothes. So therefore that proved that we was close range. But he got on the stand and told the jury that physical evidence was indicative of something else. He said it was something else all differently. But when every other expert came and testified that physical evidence could not exist without it being a close contact shooting. But the state's attorney needed for the shooting to be in such a way where as though the man was running away and my life wasn't in danger, so I shouldn't have fired a shot. That's what they needed to prove to the jury, which ultimately they proved based on the fraudulent testimony of Mr. Joseph Caparo, and I was sentenced to life at 16. Life in 23 years.
So everything came. The first thing that happened was you got sentenced to life, and then everything happened after that. The sentence was reduced once we found out that expert had lied.
Yes, 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 yes. Once we found out the expert had lied, in 2007, we found out the expert had lied. It still took me another 12 years of fighting to ultimately be released from prison. After that,
so the main thing through my mind was, here you are. Those 12 years, what was that like?
It was like a Jolly Rancher, you know, hard but sweet at times, because I knew in the back of my mind that if I just was able to wake up every morning, stay alive, throughout the prison system, because, you know, you can go from dead, living at lunch to dead by dinner, you know. So to stay alive and survive this, that 12 years was one of the things that helped me do that, was the fact that I believe at the end of the tunnel that I was going to have, I see a light there with this case right here. But every time we filed something, it was denied. Then the Court of Appeals got involved, and I thought that I would have some relief through me being a juvenile at the time I was sentenced. And then that didn't work out. That was shot down too. That didn't work out. But I had an attorney. I had paid attorneys, but then I wound up accumulating and receiving some money so I could pay another attorney. In that process, I received a letter from the public defender office. And Mr. Eli Braun had took over the case. And Mr. Braun told me, and he promised me, he gave me his word. I'll never forget, he said that from this day forward, I will stick and fight with you until you are released. And, you know, I'd have heard that before. And personally, I don't know, through the years, I have developed a attitude of not all that optimistic. From having doors closed constantly, I wasn't all that optimistic. I was more pessimistic. You know, I when a person tell me something and they're going to do something, I mean, when they show me, then I believe it. So I wanted to believe, let's just say that, I wanted to believe that what he said he was going to do. So I stuck with him. He stuck with me. And ultimately, he filed a petition to reopen my case. And I kept going in front of a judge named Peters, and Peters was hard. He kept shooting it down. So somehow my lawyer said he was going to talk to a court clerk of Shannon Avery, which was the judge name. She was a female judge named Shannon Avery. Mm-hmm. And that's who it went in front of, Shannon Avery. So in 2017, he filed the petition. By 2018, December 9th, I believe, 2018, they said that they would hear the petition. So
okay.
In the process of them saying they would hear the petition, I told my friends, man, I was going to court. I had a court date. I was going to court. So I had two friends, one named James Featherstone, who was already released from prison after doing 34 years, and another friend of mine named Cortez. And I don't want to call him a victim. His name is Keith Gaddy. That's the guy that was shot and killed. I knew the family. I knew him well. I knew him. That was the family, and that was the man, that individual's name was Keith Gaddy. So Mr. Gaddy's family knew me. His brother was one of the people who was my tutor. He used to teach me how to read when I was little. So unbeknownst to me, when I went to court that day, that morning, I was prepared to go in there and argue my case. And the lawyer came downstairs and said, we got some developments that changes everything today. We're not going to have to hear. It's going to be a little different when you go up there. So he didn't tell me all the details right then and there at the bullpen. So when I went upstairs, Mr. Gaddy's brother was there, Kirk Gaddy. His oldest brother was there, and he was the director of St. Francis Academy, the school, St. Francis Academy.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
Okay, he was the director, and I say was the director because tragically, after I was released, 90 days later, or something of that nature, he died of a heart attack. I get to that later, but anyway, he.
So fast forward for me a little bit. So you get into prison.
I'm a fast forward. We where you want me to go? To when I got sentenced, we in prison?
Yes.
How I got out?
Either one, whichever one you prefer. Because we're going to get some questions in. Our time is a little bit limited. We're going to get some questions in.
Okay, well, let me just fast forward. Okay, I went to prison at 16. I went to Maryland Penitentiary, 954 Fall Street. Okay. You know a lot of people in prison, and prison had a different atmosphere. I didn't walk around worrying about being attacked or violated sexually or anything of that nature as a kid, as a young guy, because I had a lot of friends from my neighborhood there that were older, who was already in there, who looked out for me. I had an older brother who was in there who looked out for me, a couple cousins, relatives, but nevertheless, everything was all right in that area as far as that. The hardest thing about prison for me was the mental thing. the not knowing, you know, and then I developed two fears while I was in prison. One being never getting out before, and my mother passing or dying while I was in prison, and me myself dying of old age in prison. They was my two biggest fears.
So can I ask you a quick question? Unless yeah. one of our fellows has this question, and I want one of the fellows to come in. Anybody can volunteer. Alicia, you want to check the chats and let's get a question to somebody asking you about just what you're talking about right now of your fear of dying in prison and never mm-hmm. getting out. I need one of the fellows to ask you a question related to that scenario. Anybody want to pick one, Alicia?
I'll say, hey, I got a question for it. Nobody put anything in the chat yet.
Go ahead. You go ahead then. Thank you. So
I guess, like, what would you say was your biggest fear when you were in prison?
Oh, well, you know, the first thing was not knowing. See, you know, you fear that what you don't know. So not knowing what to expect when I went in the door, that was I don't even want to say that was a fear. That was more of a concern than a fear. My fear more or less was dying in prison of old age or my mother passing. You know, that was my two biggest fears. Through my whole incarceration, they was the two constants. Them two fears right there. You know, dying in prison. Because I would see guys that were stabbed and die. And I was just talking to him yesterday or the day before or lunchtime, and then he did by dinner. So that was my fear. Dying in prison of old age or being killed in prison. I didn't want them two things to happen. I wanted to go out the way I came in, walk out.
Can I ask you a question? This is Shamsuddin Greg, by the way. And I'm glad you was able to be a part of this project. But in that fear, inside of that fear, how did you deal with it? I mean, what were some of the things that allowed you to maintain your sanity, just knowing that these possibilities could be real?
Well, initially, my first reaction was that of the most traveled road, which was getting in trouble, using drugs, things of that nature. That was my coping mechanism, getting high. But then it came a time where I believe in 1984, 85, I took my Shahada and became Muslim. And as time went on, I started taking the deen kind of seriously. So when I started reading the Islam and taking the deen kind of seriously, believe it or not, Islam is what ultimately saved me. The lawyer came, yeah, that was cool. My mother was fortunately, she lived a long, you know, most of my bit. She died in 2008 while I was still incarcerated. But nevertheless, she stuck with me. She was there for a lot of that bit. So therefore, Islam ultimately saved me. Islam ultimately is what got me over the hump, because it came a time where I abandoned using drugs and getting in trouble. And I became positive. I became a mentor. I became a mentor to the younger guys. And I became a suicide watch aide. That job was a job I took. And I through helping other people and bestowing on other people what I learned and went through, ultimately, that's what saved me, though. That's what helped me.
Okay, so far, Mr. Mark has really given us a lot.
Real quick.
Okay, I'm going to let you come in. I want you to come in as soon as I'm done. I'm glad to hear you ask this question, too. We've talked a little bit about leading up to going into jail. He's really given us some good introspect there. So keep your questions short, and let's not talk anymore about leading up to jail. Let's talk about experiences in jail and a little bit more about what's going on after jail. Go ahead. Please ask your question.
I had a question. So my question is, what was your experience in there? Was you nervous? Was you kind of like scared, or kind of like, was your mentality ready to survive that longer sentence that you was in? Like, knowing that you're going to be in here, are you ready to survive, or are you going to be like a weak mindset? Because I know different penitentiaries is different.
Oh no, I'm from Lexington Projects, and anybody is familiar with Baltimore and Lexington Projects in the 80s. It's where the movie The Wire was set. And my mentality was strong. You know, I never made no suicide attempts. Some days I may have crossed my mind that, boy, if I just die, this will be over. You know, just before the Islam, I thought like that when I was just ripping and running through the prison. And I was going to be a man's man. I was going to stand up. I was going to protect myself, defend myself at all costs. And even as a 16-year-old, I didn't have a physical fear, honestly. My fear, you know, I was nervous about a lot of things in prison, but I had fights and stabbings involved, and there are things in prison. And at no time in prison did I ever consider taking a weak route seriously. You know, at no times, you know. I wanted to see my family again. I wanted to see my mother again. And so, therefore, I just ain't want to die in prison. And especially, I didn't want to die in prison for a crime that I didn't believe I deserved to be sentenced to life for anyway.
Anybody else on the chat line, Alicia? Go ahead. You have one more question?
I'll wait after he's done.
So, okay. Go ahead. You go ahead and do this for us, Alicia. Pick somebody.
My question was, what was racing through your mind when you were told that the officer had killed himself? Were you joyous, lost, confused? I just really want to know, because if it were me, I'd feel confused yet joyous.
Well, I was not joyous, not at all. I would prefer him to be living. I needed him to be living. Yeah, because I believe if he was living, that it wouldn't have took me 12 years, because he would have been in a position where as though they could have questioned him and backed him in the corner and got some answers. See, when he killed himself, the truth died with him. What he did and how he did it, it died with him. So him dying didn't benefit me. You know what I'm saying? Now, the truth coming out benefited me, but him dying itself, no, I wasn't happy that he died. I didn't take no pleasure, no joy in him dying. Really, I really can say that I really felt a little bit disappointed that, you know, that the individual would kill himself. And by the way, he wouldn't even went to jail for what he did. He wouldn't even went to jail for it. So I couldn't understand. I would say I was confused about why would he kill himself? Why did he just go ahead and face the music? You know what I'm saying? But then I started thinking, like, a person who was willing to lie and help send another human being to prison for the rest of his life, when after my experience in prison, I wouldn't wish prison on my worst enemy, personally. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. So therefore, for him to do this and then kill himself, I was very, very disappointed that he killed himself, and I was not joyous at all. I was confused, though, about why he would do that.
Continue facilitating for us, Alicia. Who else you got?
I guess I can ask a question real quick. My question for you is, how did you discover Islam, and do you still practice Islam?
Oh, yes. I still attend Juma and everything now out here. You know, when you come out here in society, you know, you got a lot of things going on for us. The time in the day is not the same as time in prison. Time in prison seem to be, you know, a constant thing. You can, but out here, you got to take advantage of every minute. So, yes, I still practice it, and I discovered it because, you know, most of my friends was in the Islamic community. And every Friday at 1 o'clock, the same thing happened every day. Everybody in the population had disappeared because the Muslims outnumber all the other religions in the jail, by the way. You know, they might be 200, 300, 400 Muslims at a time in any given jail. Depends on how big the jail is, how many people the jail hold. But the Muslims outnumber everybody in the jail. So every Friday, everybody was gone. And when I be looking for somebody, I couldn't find them. They ain't on the chair, they ain't in the yard. They had Juma. You know, and guys used to tell me, I used to say, man, such and such happened while y'all was at Juma. And they'd be like, if you was at Juma, then you know, you wouldn't have got caught up in that, or that wouldn't have went on. So, you know, I start giving it some thought, and I start really giving it some thought, and I start reading. And God softened my heart and led me to the religion. Because, you know, that's I believe that's what he wanted for me, because it came a time where I thought I wasn't going to never get out of prison. And I told God that I'm going to be cool with that decision. If he thinks that this is better for me than anything else he got in the world, if prison is the best thing for me, then I would take that and I would go to my grave knowing that I received the best that God had to offer for me at that time. And so that's what I did. I started practicing the religion a lot better year by year. So the Ramadan, which is a fasting time for the Muslims, when we fast that 2018 fast, I fast like this was going to be my last fast on earth. I followed the rules and regulations of the fast to the fullest. And instead of death, God took me back to court, opened the door for me, because I wanted to tell y'all something that was real profound, because I don't want this not to get in this discussion. I don't want y'all not to hear this. When I was in that bullpen going to court that day, when the lawyer came in there and told me it had been a change of developments, and I went back upstairs, Mr. Gaddy, remember that name? That's the guy that was killed, that was murdered that day, that got killed that night. Mr. Gaddy's brother was up there, and he told the judge, the state's attorney, and everybody in the courtroom that was present that his mother passed away, but before she died, she forgave him. He told a little bit about the history of knowing me and said that he forgave me and he didn't want me to die in prison and he wouldn't have no problem with the judge letting me go right then and there that day. Unfortunately, they didn't let me go that particular day, but within a matter of weeks, I was released from prison. And big part of it was based on the individual that I became and the fact that the family was backing me and supporting me coming home. And the family took a vote amongst the family, and the majority of the family said that they wouldn't be home. And they had some stipulations. And I told them I wouldn't follow. I couldn't follow all the stipulations that they had, because some of the stipulations that they had was unrealistic, you know, honestly. Because, you know, they wanted me not to go in certain parts of Baltimore City. And I say, that's unrealistic. You know, of course, I won't hang around your house or be approached none of y'all, but I can't not go. You know, they wanted me not to go from Charles Street to Broadway and from maybe Fleet Street on up to Greenmount Avenue, to North Avenue, I mean. You know, they didn't want me to go in that corridor. They had a map drop where they didn't want me to go, which was, the judge said, was illegal in itself, but I told him that everything else I promised, but they said the only reason they drew that map was because they didn't want me to come home, get caught up in the cycle, and be involved in drugs, crime, and whatever was going on in them communities right there. You know, in my old community where I lived at, that's why they had that map drew up for real. That's what they said.
But, wow. That is really, it's like you can't even walk around the corner. Can't even go outside to take a deep breath with all that restriction. Right. You know what? We are down to about, I'd say, 8 minutes left. Maybe we time for questions. Okay, I'm gonna leave it on you, Alicia. I think we're gonna boil it down to one last question. And okay, those who don't get their questions in this time, we'll have on our next interview after 7. And they can ask some questions then.
Tyler asked a good question.
Yeah, in the chat. I kind of messed up on because I misunderstood a little bit. I was just asking, how does it feel knowing that like you went to jail or like you were sitting in jail because like no one really knew the truth? And I said, like, how I really said it was like knowing how the story was getting thrown around, because like, you know, if you were in court and if the man killed himself before all of this, before all the court stuff happened, and if it's all based off of everybody else's opinions or what the judge thinks, how does it feel like knowing that you went to jail based on like everybody not knowing the truth, and it's just a bunch of going to jail in the paint on opinions, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, I guess what you asking is, how did I feel about sitting in jail knowing that I didn't do what they said I did, but I was in there for what they believed I did?
Right.
Okay, well, I didn't in prison, things moving real fast, and it's a dangerous place, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not, because of the time constraint, I'm not giving it is the full weight of really exactly how dangerous and how much I went through emotionally. Most of my problems in prison was emotional, from a mental standpoint. You know, these are things that you battle with in your head, you know, because it seemed like when that door closed, when you're in that cell, everything seems worse than what it really is. If you can understand that, even though, you know, I'm in prison and I wouldn't recommend it for nobody, but believe me, everything seemed worse than what it really is, because you wouldn't believe all I went through on the day that I was released from prison. Around 12 o'clock, the judge made a decision. They sent me back to the prison around 7 that evening. They walked me out the door around 12 o'clock midnight. And they didn't even give me the $50 that they were supposed to give me in my account. They wanted to take me. The officers got together, got some money together, and gave me some money. And they was going to let me out by the horseshoe. Now, take it, I've never been down a horseshoe. I don't know where the horseshoe at. I just know that they said when they get off the highway, they're going to let me off at the corner of this street, that street, and I'm going to have to figure it out from there. You know, so it's basically be throwing out a moving car after 33 years of incarceration, and I got to figure it out. And while I'm figuring it out, don't get locked up. Don't do nothing wrong. Don't break no laws. You know, you got to. So it was a little bit, I never set the prison and dwelled on the fact that I was here for something I didn't do. I didn't think I was innocent, because I actually pulled that trigger. I actually was selling drugs. And I started looking at the analogy that if you shoot a man at 6 o'clock and the man walk into the bar at 6:15, he take 3-4 drinks. By 8 o'clock, he died as a result of sitting in the bar drinking. Then you ask yourself, who is at fault? Is it because the man didn't go seek medical treatment that he died? Or is it the fact that you actually shot him? Because had I never shot him, he would have never needed medical treatment. So then, you know, you ask yourself these things. So I sat in that cell and I said, you know what? I'm responsible for his death in spite of whatever, however we came in contact with each other that night. I had the gun. I pulled the trigger. I was the drug dealer.
And I didn't even think of it like that.
Yeah, before you go on, before we go on, now we're going to have to end it. I mean, see, it's getting good. I like that. Your mind is working, but we're really on a time deadline. So okay. If this is Tyler, I'm not sure who this is talking. I think it's Tyler.
It's me.
Whoever it is, hold your question for our next interviewee in the next few minutes, because we got to stay on time. So, Mr. Mark, we need you to, like, put all this in synopsis for us. It's 6:56. We got to do this within 2 to 3 minutes because we've got somebody else waiting to talk to. We're going to leave the last word to you to let us know, like, what are you doing now, now that you're free? How is life treating you? And briefly, anything you want to say, just to, to give words of wisdom.
Okay, well, I'll say this.
Please go ahead.
Since I've been home, I managed, you know, I'm enrolled in college right now. I just got finished doing my college homework before I got on the Zoom. I go to Howard County University. I mean, I go to Howard County College out here in Howard County, Columbia, Maryland.
Yeah, Howard County Community College. One of my sons graduated from there.
Yeah, I go to Howard County Community College. I'm majoring in human services. This is my third semester right here that I'm completing right now. And I'm trying to get a degree in human services so I can be an addictions counselor from there. Take it and call it to an addictions counselor. I got engaged a couple months ago. I'll be married in June. I've been working since I've been home. I done had a job. I have a driving license. I own a car. I do the same thing everybody else do now. I got the same 24 hours in my day that everybody got in theirs now. And I say that to say I work, I pay bills, I exercise, I ride my bike, you know, and I live all the way out in the county. So, and I do want to say this, though. The prison, I didn't come out totally unscarred. You know, I really do believe that I have little hangups because, you know, I still can't sleep with the bedroom door open. Every time I see a police drive past, I ain't doing nothing, but I take 2-3 looks back. You know, it's just one of them things. My recipe for success, and I tell everybody, this is my part of wisdom, and my part, y'all, with this right here, is to be practical. And when I say to be practical, meaning that I just did 33 years. It would not be practical for me to come home after 33 years, get some money, take the last bit of money I got, go into a studio, and say I'm going to make a rap album. I'm going to be a rapper at 53 years old, having to do 33 years in prison. That is not practical. You know what I'm saying? Or taking my money, going to the gambling spot and say I'm a gamble and try to get a come up like that. You know, they are not practical things. The practical thing for me is to work, maintain family, respect other people. And my value for human life is so way off the chart that I got to remind myself sometimes I can't save everybody. Because when I ride through Baltimore City, it needs saving, and I be wanting to get out my car and help everybody. You know what I'm saying? But it's one of them things where as though I'm going to do everything humanly possible to make sure that if God allow me, I don't need much. I told him. I asked him, give me 20, 25 years of freedom, and I'm good after that.